to say a torso. You know what? A torso. A fucking a torso.
Hey, it is me, Riley Quinn, who you may or may not know from the show Trash Future, coming at you on a new RSS feed in a new country about a new topic. That is right. It is the first episode of mine and Dan Beckner's Canada politics show, The Bottleman. Dan, how's it feel to be part of the, fifth wave of podcasts, getting in somewhere on the mezzanine level?
It feels good, man. Feels great. I feel like the wave, the good times will never end, you know?
Absolutely. It is why Spotify has just decided that its $250 million investment in the medium has been a waste.
So funny. Well, maybe they should have designed a good user interface for people who love podcasts. Yeah.
Or maybe Casper mattresses should have had a better business model.
Yes.
We are thrilled to have you here with us today as we begin our strange exploration of the Great White North, of my homeland, of Dan's current home, of Canada. A country that is well known for being clean, polite, liberal, free of scandals, and don't ask about all the Nazi cemeteries that are dotted up and down the country.
That's right. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, you know, like, what do we talk about when we talk about Canada? Like, do we talk about the weather? Do we talk about snow? Do we talk about the large amount of Ukrainian Nazi memorabilia and cemeteries and monuments? Do we talk about a place where if somebody publishes a list of people in media who are related to each other and the entire media class spends the rest of the day defensively posting about how nepotism as a concept is not real? You know, is that what we're talking
about?
That's
racism against POC, people of connection. Without too much further ado, also to join us in our maiden voyage, it is our friend, journalist and researcher, left-wing, lefty activist, it's Luke Savage, and the host of the Michael and Us podcast, it's Luke Savage.
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the ground floor of a fantastic venture. I assume you will be sending us your investment check soon.
Well, yeah, it's not going to match the $140 million that Rogan got from Spotify, but it'll be somewhere in the ballpark.
Well, I guess that ends Luke's guest spot on the Bottleman. Luke, thank you very much for coming and talking to us today. We are delighted to have you here. And I think, you know, that's a very good question to ask, you know, to open this, right, is what do we think about when we talk about Canada? It's a question that I ask all the time because I've lived outside of Canada for my entire adult life. You know, I grew up here. I moved to the UK when I was 21, and I sort of for a while didn't particularly miss Canada because I was, you know, so excited about, you know, the world beyond the 401. And then I think in the last few years, I've had this real sense of nostalgia. I've had this real sense of wanting to reconnect with Canada. But at the same time, the more I learn about Canada, the more I'm like, that is a supremely fucked up place. How many of the alt-right did we produce? What percent?
Yeah, a lot of the big ones. But I mean, look, that's actually a really good place to begin because one of the consequences of being a small country that's inundated with, you know, stuff from the United States, like mass media from the United States and also, you know, Britain, but also just is culturally dwarfed by, you know, most other countries in the world in one form or another. You know, you end up, you know, as Canadians, you end up consuming like a foreign impression of what your own country is, right? And since like there is this idea of Canada already, like the one you're taught in public schools, the one that you were describing right off the top, like, that is kind of what the received wisdom about Canada is elsewhere, particularly in the United States. So like when our prime minister like is on the cover of Rolling Stone, you know, that's a news event in Canada, and that's how people consume it. Like, mm-hmm. it's like, look, our prime minister made the cover of Rolling Stone. Like, mm-hmm. so much so that people don't even, like, read the interview that he did, which actually was really weird and is full of weird shit, you know?
Wait, Justin Trudeau gave a weird interview in exchange for fawning celebrity media coverage? That doesn't sound right. So, like, I figured, like, it would be worth on this first episode as a little bit of an activity of table setting, especially for sort of American or British listeners who might be tuning in. I wanted to talk about, like, what, when we talk about Canada, the three of us here, and I assume, like, many people listening to this podcast, especially the Canadians who are listening, well, we kind of know, we have a better sense of what we mean. We think we mean some place that is a place that is very preoccupied with lying to itself about what it is. And very preoccupied with a vision of its own history that's very complimentary, because everything, a lot that of what you're taught in Canadian school and stuff is all about how we're not the U.S. We're not the U.S. We didn't have slavery. We didn't have a revolution. We aren't sort of leading the war on terror. We didn't have, you know, dumb George Bush. We didn't have Donald Trump. We didn't even have that bad of a financial crisis. Again, goes the received wisdom that we are somehow, because of our natural sense of probity or some kind of, you might say, cultural big L liberalism and small c conservatism, sort of immune to these wild swings of fortune. And that's something that's inculcated in high school history, where I think I've sort of written a four-line version of Canadian history here, which is that John A. Macdonald invented Canada to send beaver pelts back to England to make the big hats that were in style at the time. A bunch of United Empire loyalists and French seigneurialists came together to create a nation based on compromise. And that nation based on compromise then went on to do everything bad the U.S. did, but like not nearly as bad, so basically better, and then invented peacekeeping. And then we exported Jim Carrey and Ryan Stiles to the United States. And there we are.
Yeah, I mean, that's about it. I mean, you got it.
So I think this is like given rise then to, yeah, what you might call Canadian, a kind of Canadian exceptionalism, right? And, you know, I think one of the effect, one of the sort of, if you want to think about Canadian exceptionalism, it is this idea that we are somehow immune to these problems, that all of these, like the waves of the revanchist right that have swept across the US and UK, that we're probably not going to have to deal with those because of this historical and temperamental mildness, essentially, right? And, you know, I mean, I think like, and this is something that we're going to sort of get into as we go through the episode, but I think what this is, the net effect of this, and I think, again, Dan, what you said earlier about the list of the fact that everyone in media is cousins, the insularity and sort of just blithe overconfidence of this attitude means that I believe that, especially from an outside perspective, the like elite liberal media and political establishment has no idea and is unable to deal with what could be coming in the form of just like an upsurge of nationalism, right? Yeah, Luke, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very, you know, there's like a very obvious kind of self-denial that comes with all of this. And it's especially like it comes in the form of, like I was saying before, flattery from abroad. And I think this is dying down a little, but sort of 2015, 2016, 2017 was like the absolute peak of this, because, you know, it's true that there's a Canadian exceptionalism, but there's kind of two sides to it. It's very strange. Like on the one hand, it's like, you know, it's exceptionalism of the kind that, you know, most nation states have, which is just like, we're the best by virtue of existing. But then there is this like apologetic sort of provincial element to it where, you know, we're constantly seeking approval from abroad. And when I say abroad, I guess I mainly mean the United States here. So like 2015 to 2017, 2018 was the absolute peak of that, because you had Justin Trudeau becoming prime minister in November of 2015. And then there was this like, year-ish, a little more than that, I guess, where, you know, like he and Obama were synonymous. And so that was like, you know, that was like huge because, when Trudeau went down to D.C. To meet with Obama and the whole entire press corps went with them, like it was like this huge national event. It's like the entire political establishment right down to the media like got to go on a big field trip to hang out with the cool people in DC. And then once Trump got elected, this stuff just went into absolute like overdrive mode because inside Canada we wanted to tell ourselves like, you know, oh, this is not us. We have this better thing. Like this, it couldn't happen here. We're above this. But then we were being fed that story everywhere, right? Because for reasons that I don't fully understand, the entirety of the global media is always on the hunt for like the next who's the not Donald Trump, right? Mm-hmm. Who's the like liberal, who's the like Davos hero like du jour? And until he was sort of semi dethroned by the Jupiterian president, Emmanuel Macron, and then I guess later by Jacinda Ardern, who does at least seem to have presided over one of the most more effective COVID responses. Like Trudeau was the reigning champion of this, like undisputed for years. And I mean that's obviously going to lend itself to a kind of complacency, like when you'd rather be flattered by the cool kids than like think about the things that you mentioned, like the fact that Canada seems to produce, particularly for its size, an inordinate number of far right, you know, YouTube personalities. You're not going to think about that stuff when you're busy, fapping to Justin Trudeau on the cover of Rolling Stone or whatever it is.
Yeah, and that cultivation of flattery too creates a kind of consent manufacturing feedback loop in sort of like bourgeois Canadian culture, where during that period, when Trudeau was being held up as like the prince of neoliberalism or whatever, during that period we meaning Canada engaged in some of the most like corrosive imperialistic foreign policy jaunts that this country has ever gone on, like backing the Lima Group, backing actual coups in the global South,
sending arms to Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm. spending $1 billion propping up post Maidan pro Azov government in Ukraine, you know, like that's, I think for me, my sort of radicalization and realization of this started with looking up the Ukrainian military mission, Canada's military mission in Ukraine. And the more I looked at it, the more I was just like, oh, this is just like our media is just a consent manufacturing machine for like resource extraction companies and like personal beefs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like so all of that positioning, whether it's the sort of, whether it is the breathless coverage of someone like Trudeau as who has like an anti-Trump, or whether it's even like the self-sucking that our financial press does about how wonderful our prudential regulation was, such that we sort of avoided a American-style Great Recession because we didn't have the exact same kinds of like speculative financial instruments. Never mind the sort of monopoly that our banks enjoy, not to mention like everything else. It means that any attempt to come to an understanding that a more radical politics is necessary and a better Canada is possible is sort of blunted by self-satisfaction, is blunted by a sort of cloud, a choking cloud of smugness that sort of emanates from Rosedale or and Westmount and wherever in Vancouver is nice, you know, etc. And I mean, if you ask the ordinary Canadian sort of what this country is, what's it about, why it is the way it is, they will, I think, as we've been discussing, give you a number of examples related to stuff Canada has never done. They'll tell you what we didn't do. They'll tell you how we're not like the US. And And but like if you want to draw parallels to the US, I think sort of, you know, the sponsorship of the Azov government is actually a much better one than looking at sort of the different way in which we committed sort of historical crimes, right? You know, because if you want to talk about sort of shaking hands with fascist regimes overseas in order to fulfill domestic policy objectives, such as, you know, Operation Paperclip or whatever, you never keep fascism far away. It never stays at arm's length. You start with it on the frontier, but the frontier always comes home.
You
right?
always bring that back home, and it's I mean, that's a pretty good example. Like Canada's tactical weaponization of fascist diaspora from Eastern Europe post Second World War to crush a local labor movement being carried out by the first wave of immigrants from that same place. So,
I mean, I think what I'd like to get to now, right, is a little bit of Canadian history, the roots of this idea, right? When you ask a Canadian, you say, what did we do? Well, we didn't have a revolution. We came to an agreement with Britain. You know, we, of course, being white Canada. We came to an agreement with Britain, or we sort of were conquered and made peace with Britain. That is Anglo and French white Canada. We didn't have slavery. And that, you know, that ignores, again, that ignores sort of hundreds of years of, again, like brutal racism and so on. We didn't start any wars. Again, that I think, as we've been talking about, we didn't start any wars, but we certainly do work with fascists overseas. We didn't participate in any regime toppling. Again, not that you know of.
Except we've been told about.
We don't have the Cheeto in Sussex Drive. We didn't have a nice financial crisis, and racism is not as big of a problem in Canada because we have a multicultural history. And then people point to the existence of Quebec saying, look, these two cultures had to live in harmony in history, which is why, you know, in Canada, we do not have a sort of, again, revanchist conservatism. Again, overlooking the fact that what have we had in the last years? How many sort of far right mass killing events? We had the Polytechnic. We had Alec Messanian. We had the fellow in New Brunswick, and also so, Luke. I mean, what? These are some points that I listed down. What else comes to your mind if someone was to ask you what is it? What makes Canada Canada? What's the a common thing someone might think?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it comes from kind of a particular image of Canada that was emerged and was also created in the 1960s and 70s. It's important to note here what a new country Canada actually is. I mean, and, you know, I think in some ways the place to begin is not even really 1867. I mean, that's when the, like, fragmented, you know, provincial bureaucracies, like these settler bureaucracies, like come together in like a bigger federal structure. But it's not until really the, you know, mid-20th century that like this is crystallized, that it kind of gets an identity, you know, unto itself. And I mean, the story of that is pretty complicated. But, you know, I think when people think of Canada, certainly what I was taught in like public school, it's always with reference to these kind of like, you know, it's like Expo 67, it's Trudeau mania, like it's official bilingualism, it's official multiculturalism, it's peacekeeping, right? And, you know, there's a lot to discuss in relation to each of those, but, and there's like some fact and some fiction at play here. But one thread with all those things that they all come from around the same period, like a roughly kind of 10 or 15 year stretch. And this is where like Trudeau, the name Trudeau is also very applicable because, you know, the irony of Justin Trudeau's rise in 2015, which like a lot of people received and kind of processed as this like great leap forward into like a exciting new future, was in many ways like this nostalgic trip, like back to this earlier time where all these reference points were created, because that's when the modern Canadian identity like that you're describing was really forged.
Mm. And I mean, I think what we get there, right, is it's a place where our liberal movement, especially sort of after Stephen Harper, was one of, I think, as you're exactly right, nostalgia was one of this, like, we are going to define ourselves by this wonderful period of the 1960s, where I remember there was a big media scandal where Pierre Elliott Trudeau ran across a street in front of some cameras. They were like, oh, the prime minister put on a show for the cameras. And it was just him jogging across the street, which reminds me actually of how incredibly conservative, socially conservative, Canadian, especially Anglo-Canadian society was until that time. Where, I, as I recall, like when my mother was in university, she worked at a bar called the Seeps in University of, near the University of Western Ontario. So, you know, it's, if anyone knows that, I'm sure they do. And when she was working there, you were not allowed, and this was a morality law specifically, you were not allowed to pick up your beer and walk from one table to another table with it. You had to get a waiter to come, put it on a little platter, and they would take it with you because they thought that would encourage rowdiness.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I remember the bar in my, in the small town I grew up in had, I mean, obviously they changed the laws and anyone could use any entrance, but they had separate entrances for men and women. Mm-hmm. Out in rural British Columbia. Yeah. Just extremely, extremely conservative mindset, extremely Protestant, like.
Yeah, and there was this, and after this, and I think, Luke, as you described, this opening in the 1960s, we ended up with this idea of like we say, defining ourselves in opposition to the states. And in post 2008, what that means is that there is a broad consensus in Canada, I think, that we are a functional liberal society, and the UK and US are not. This is because of this essentially Canadian politeness restraint, whatever you want to call it, that has been inculcated in us throughout our history and is something that is not really subject to external forces. It's endogenous. It's in us. And it is. And we believe that, you know, we can just sort of go on. We can just sail on into the future, enjoying our, like I said, functional liberal society. And so the problem, the fundamental problems of liberalism, problems that have, let's say, come to a bit of a head in the US and UK, you know, it's not that they're not going to come to a head in Canada, but we seem to believe that they won't. We seem to be very comfortable in the belief that that is not going to happen. You know?
Yeah, and one of the strange things here, which both makes me very depressed and pessimistic, but also kind of optimistic at the same time, is I actually do think, like, I mean, this is obviously a huge generalization, but I think Canadians on the whole, like, just individually, like, taken as a group, are less conservatively inclined than, like, the United States, than Americans are. I mean, our structures that we get from, like, you know, British Toryism are like less conservative than the American. I mean, we don't have we have the Senate and you know, things like that. We're still a constitutional monarchy, but it's like, if you get a parliamentary majority in Canada, you can just like make laws, which like
crazy.
Democrats like obviously exaggerate like the political constraints they face because they don't want to do anything, right? But it's like in Canada, you legitimately can, like, imagine Canada, if there's an American analog to it, like politically, right? It's like Rhode Island or Massachusetts or California or one of these states where there's just like solid like blue super majorities all the time. Like that's what Canada is, right? And like the difficulty comes from the fact that like a lot of times Canadians are voting for Canadians who are voting liberal, like 2015 being a really good example of this, think that they're voting for something that they're not. Like they think that they're voting for a left-wing government and for policies that you might kind of broadly describe as like social democratic. I am still convinced that Canadians, you know, and the polling like bears this out, actually, you know, do support raising taxes on the rich, regulating tech companies, democratic reform, run down the list. I think there's like majority support for all of it, but it's very hard to make any of that stuff a reality when people already think they're living in some kind of like multiracial Switzerland with a Scandinavian welfare state. You know what I mean? Which I think is what a lot of people think. And actually, like, I this is my hobby horse, so, like, but not to belabor this too much, but, like, in 2015, when Trudeau got elected, like, if you look at a lot of the coverage, the take, you know, and to some extent here, but internationally as well, which, like, as I've already said, is what a lot of people are reading. You know, the take was Canada just elected the most left-wing government anywhere in the world. Like, you can read, like, there were comparisons between Justin Trudeau and Bernie Sanders. There was, I think an article in The Independent that described Justin Trudeau as it was shaping up to be the most ambitious liberal premiership in modern history. The example was it, and the sort of hook for the article was that Justin Trudeau was going to give every Canadian a basic income, which, like, is not a thing that happened. But if you kind of read the fine print, the Liberals were, like, supportive of some kind of very small pilot project that experimented with, like, giving people a basic income in, like, one town or something. But so it's just people again and again are have this exaggerated idea of, like, the way things already are, whatever their preferences about how they should be are. And that makes it very difficult to, like, have a kind of, I don't know, like, advocate any kind of genuinely progressive politics in Canada, because people think, like, people's impression of what the country is often so so wildly off base because of, like, the narratives that they're being fed.
And I to that point, like, the desert of left media in Canada is, it kind of contributes to that. You know, there are very few outlets that are challenging that narrative, that are challenging sort of the perceived radicalism of the Liberal Party. And you know, outlets like CBC, who are, you know, national broadcaster, kind of use the specter of the right as a hammer to discourage criticism or discourage sort of even just investigating a little further, but how left are the Liberals, you know, which is a huge problem.
Yeah. And you'll hear mainstream journalists say stuff like, the Liberal Party's moved so far to the left that there's, like, no more space, like, over there and stuff like that. It's ridiculous. Or, I can't remember which right-wing op-ed writer wrote this in, like, 2015 or 2016, but there was a characterization probably in the Financial Post or the National Post of the Liberal government as one that thinks that the state can solve every problem. And it's like, where do you conceivably get that impression? Like, that is a received wisdom that, like, you're reading in the, you can read that in the largest media chain in the country. And, like, that's something that you, that's like a straw man that you could, like, knock over with a flick of the wrist. Like, it's the most like stupid, like formless argument you could make.
You mean Justin Trudeau and Chrissy Freeland aren't sending cadres to Lethbridge to do land reform?
Wait, are you telling me that the vineyards in Niagara on the Lake are not going to be subject to collectivization? the kulaks of Enniskillen will still walk free?
Oh my god, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I'm swearing my allegiance to the Innisville Soviet.
I actually would swear my allegiance to certain Niagara wine Soviets, but that's neither here nor there.
God's plan for Vancouver Island now.
So, like, I think that one of the things you can talk about here as well is, like, you know who really benefits from that, like, again, like, right-wing lie about the Liberal Party, that they are the ones who believe that there is a state solution to things, that there's all their wacky leftists and whatever. The Liberal Party, they really benefit from that characterization of them in the National Post.
It's a completely symbiotic relationship, and actually both the Liberal and the Conservative parties benefit from this, and to some extent I think are even aware of how kind of useful this is, because the Liberals being perceived that way allows the Conservatives to fundraise and campaign in really the only way they know how, which is to shout at a kind of, I mean, sometimes rural, but often just like suburban constituency, like, you know, the Liberal Party are radicals and, you know, I don't know, they want to do, So yeah, the conservatives say this, like they brand the liberals as extremists, which is kind of like the way they do, you know, their like reactionary version of like the Bernie small donor strategy, right? And then the liberals benefit from that as well, because if they're perceived that way, and more importantly, if they're kind of, you know, if the received wisdom in the press becomes that they're like ambitious and they believe in activist government and they want to raise taxes on the rich, et cetera, like that's their, you know, that's their whole pitch. That's how they hold together. Like when you have a liberal majority government, you know, I live in Toronto, right? And so it's like here, if you have a liberal majority government, chances are most of the seats downtown are going to be liberal, but also so are most of the seats that gave the Tories their big 2011 majority, right? The seats in Etobicoke and Vaughan and Markham, Scarborough, places like that. And like, those two things, like that is how the Liberal coalition, like that's what it is, and that's what kind of holds it together. And like you don't really get that, you know, you can't combine those two constituencies if people actually think the Liberal Party is like a kind of small, you know, small C conservative formation, which like largely it is.
Are you suggesting that some kind of ideology might be at work here?
I'm putting myself out there, but I think I am.
So also I think it's understanding sort of the liberal side of Canadian exceptionalism, how it sort of functions, who it benefits, what its ideological history is. I think we sort of done some table setting on that. Let's talk about the Canadian right, because that is a basket of very interesting people. So I put together a list. I think some people might not know. Some people might know some of these people are Canadian. I don't think everyone. I think everyone listening will be surprised by at least one entry on this list.
This is the very Canadian part of the podcast where, you know, we celebrate our achievements abroad, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The most successful people in Canada are always those who've achieved success abroad. So I'm eagerly awaiting this like list of luminaries.
Our big boys and girls who got the attention of Daddy USA.
Yeah.
That's right. All of the Canadians who have had the pleasure of meeting Donald Trump Jr. and being given a martini and a pint glass by him. We have, okay, number one, Gavin McInnes. Everyone knows that. You know, Montreal's hometown hero. Stéphane Molyneux, the most intelligent man ever to be banned from YouTube. Jordan Peterson, everyone knows that. Faith Goldie, not big outside of Canada, or not as big outside of Canada because she hitched her wagon to a Toronto mayoral run, right? Or would you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a sense of like her appeal. I mean, the thing that got her fired from the Rebel, which is kind of the most, I mean, maybe a bit of a contradiction in terms, but like the most mainstream far right outlet in Canada, if that makes sense. Like the thing that got her fired from that was
basically.
Basically it's like that model. And they've created like they've sort of been where a lot of like you know, these far right YouTube personalities got their start. So like she was down in Charlottesville, like, you know, that fateful day. And then after that, she went, you know, she was like streaming it and stuff. And then she went on the Stormfront podcast, and that was like finally a bridge too far. And she was like, oh, and then it was after that, she did a mayoral run, which like my sense of it is like, I didn't follow it that closely, although I did go to a protest at some like she and a bunch of like far right activists were like were doing some kind of like anti-refugee protest on a corner, and then she was like streaming it. There was like, you know, five or six of them, and then just like 100 police like blocking the way from the much bigger protest on the other side. My sense of her mayoral run is it actually kind of like hurt her reputation on the right, because I think she got some criticism for like not being, I mean, like she was running just like the campaign, you know, the like racist bullshit campaign you'd expect. But then I think she was also kind of running on just like this very bread and butter stuff, like just like people's like, you know, utility costs and things like that.
She tried to like sanitize a lot of people on some of her rhetoric and just got fucking rinsed in the election. And yeah, like you said, like alienated maybe some people who heard her on Stormfront.
So I suppose it's heartening to know that we're not at like Lauren Boebert territory yet, in terms of like, or Marjorie Taylor Greene, like we're not there yet where you will have an open QAnon person just being elected to a seat of power.
No, and actually, you know, one of the ironies here, which like really ties into everything we've been saying before, is that like if somebody does succeed in this kind of Canadian like far right ecosystem, like chances are they've built an audience elsewhere, especially United States. And then so they'll just move. It's like
so you're saying we have like a sort of fascist crank like spillway or valve in the form of the U.S.
Sort of. That's like right.
Saudi yeah. Arabia exporting Wahhabism, you know.
So apparently, Ezra Levant, who we discussed, and then apparently Steven Crowder, which I did not know that Steven Crowder was Steven Crowder is Canadian. Change my mind.
Wasn't he one of the voices on Arthur? Am I making that up?
You are not making that up. He was
he played
on
the Brain.
Yeah, I believe he played Brain on Arthur. Now he goes around different, again, American primarily college campuses, screaming at terrified 15-year-olds that about how many genders there are. You know, he is a very interesting character. Again, one of the, I would say, in terms of his move to the U.S. would not be part of what has widely described as been widely described as a larger brain drain problem, I think.
I mean, we can't forget anthropomorphic allergic reaction, David Frum.
Oh, indeed.
Axis of Evil.
He's on the respectable right, though. You know, he's in the resistance now because he said Orange Man bad.
Yeah. He's being actively sanitized, and re-imported to Canada. Mm-hmm. The walrus, actually, I don't know. How would you describe the walrus? They're the left, nominally left.
Well, it's like, you know, it's more of a literary magazine. That, I mean, it's like a current events magazine that, like, I think really is more about like the fiction and the poetry than the current affairs writing. I wrote one time for the Walrus. I mean, it's okay, but it's it's uneven. Let's say
they're having a symposium about optimism that features David Frum, Biff Naked, Margaret Atwood, and up until a couple weeks ago featured Shad, who was the post Gomeshi host of Q, and he's a Canadian rapper, and he published on his Twitter or just posted on his Twitter feed like excited to do this event, it's gonna be great, and people were like, Shad, no, check out who David Frum is. And to his credit, he immediately dropped out, but no one else did. So I think that Walrus event is kind of a good example of this bizarre imagined liberalism that we have here in this country, you know.
Well, it's the triumph of affect over substance at that point. You know, it's the it doesn't matter what you have done in your life. It's that you have made everyone sort of around you feel reassured, and about this subject, this sort of enduring political liberalism, is what they want to feel reassured about, and so you are back in the fold. You can commit no crime, really, other than just making people feel uncomfortable. And that's about it. And so if you say Orange Man bad, then, you know, congratulations. You've proven that you stand for Canadian values. I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up with some kind of cozied up position with the Trudeau administration because they decide that their next election strategy is going to be to try to siphon off conservative voters to head off that the potential challenge from the right. And we all know how that goes. But a couple more sort of Canadian far right figures: Steven Crowder, Lauren Southern. Here's one I didn't know: The Post Millennial. I did not know that was a Canadian publication. That was a real surprise to me.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, my sense of that is, I mean, I think they actually, like, I fear they actually do pretty good numbers on social media, but it's like, I think they just like, I think that's kind of like a place where campus conservatives get to write their, like, their stupid takes on things. Like, I think that's basically the business model.
Yeah, campus conservatives writing stupid takes to be shared by, you know, incessantly by 60-year-olds by, like, texting half of a URL to their nephews and nieces. And then we have, what, like 9 different types of Adam Waffen Division just, you know, scattered throughout the country, sort of variously sort of starting different, might say, doomed but very earnestly funny, you might say, uprising training videos and doing little training camps, like little summer adventure getaways for, you know, IT managers who've decided they've had enough of their divorce. And are going to, you know, join up with like, yeah, like Mr. Azov and his band of merry men. So we have a bunch of those, and then we also have, like, again, we have a far right party landscape that, again, like in the UK, right? The story of the Conservative Party sort of becoming what you might call its move from extremely right to, you know, extremely further right, was the common story is that, you know, they, in order to head off the challenge from UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which was running and about to sort of threatening it in sort of some small limited number of seats, they basically moved right to try to head those voters off from leaving. And there are a number of sort of Canadian parties like that, so the Canadian Nationalist Party being an example. So what I'm interested in is that a possibility, right, of the conservatives looking at a challenge from outside, from the right outside of the party structure and moving right to challenge it? Or will they move right from a takeover from the inside, from like Erin O'Toole?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the Conservative Party like always has, like, the internal politics are very straightforward, which is just like the activist base is like very different from the people that they actually need to win over. And so it's like the last Tory leadership race came down to what it always does, which is like you had Peter MacKay trying to do the like, let's be like lib and like, let's be respectable. And then you had O'Toole like successfully courting like, you know, the people who actually decide these elections, and like that gambit paid off. I don't know, like between your two possibilities, the second one is probably more likely. Like if the Conservative Party moves right, it'll probably just be because the, you know, like the base, like, you know, moves right. Like, I mean, there was a, like Maxime Bernier, the former foreign minister, who's like, it's really weird. I mean, you guys honestly could do a whole episode on him. He's like a guy that he had this cachet as like within the press galleries, like the wonk, you know, he's like the conservative guy who's like really serious about policy. For some reason, there's this whole animus towards supply management in Canada. So like regulation of the dairy industry, and Maxime Bernier's big thing was that he wanted to deregulate the dairy industry. And like, apparently like this is the metric for, like, if you're a post-media columnist, this is like the most exciting thing you've ever heard, is like deregulate dairy. But so Maxime Bernier left the Conservative Party over supply management, having been like a cabinet minister and stuff. And he started this thing, the People's Party, which, among other things, scored Rob Ford's widow as its candidate in Etobicoke North. But it didn't go anywhere. Like Bernier lost his seat. And like they didn't get a significant share of the vote. I don't remember what it was, but they didn't really have much impact. So yeah, I think if the Conservative Party moves right, it's more likely that comes from within rather than like a UKIP style thing.
Bernier surrounded himself with cranks too. That was interesting to watch the last federal election. Like every week, it seemed like a Bernier surrogate or someone in that party would be posting about race science and UFOs, like usually in the same, you know, post.
Oh yeah, it really was the like extremely online sort of like, yeah, like internet poison sort of weirdo part of the right, where I used to spend a lot of time covering the right at my old job when I worked at the Broadbent Institute, and I remember Bernier, you'd sometimes catch him on like, I guess he had sort of a minor following on like campus conservative radio in the United States. And like, I remember finding this thing where he was talking to these the hosts of this show at some campus, where his thing was like, we need to bring back the gold standard. Like it's like
guys like that.
I fucking love the gold standard.
Yeah, they love it. It's like it's just like whatever, like if you think of any kind of like chaotic, sort of like really eccentric right-wing cause, like there's probably a decent chance Bernier has like aligned himself with it at one point or another. And yet it's like, yeah, guess when he started a political party, guess who joined it, you know?
Bernier's finally going to crack down on the problem of lawlardry in Canada.
That's right. It's interesting. I was going to say, too, it's interesting, like, just talking about the Conservative Party sort of promising their base something and delivering something like a kind of watered down version of that. That's been going on. I've been doing some research on Wexit, and that's just been going on for almost 100 years. Like the Social Credit Party in Alberta, when they took over in 1930, their base thought that they were going to separate, and they had no intention of separating.
Oh yeah, and I mean the big schism now is always like anything to do with social conservatism. Like it's like Doug Ford is the leader of the PC party in Ontario and the premier, you know, as a result, because he successfully courted like, you know, there was like an evangelical candidate, like there always is, who like, you know, would be like a terrible in terms of like electorally would be terrible for the Conservative Party, but commands like a lot of like, you know, activists within it. And then, just like his predecessor, like as soon as he got elected, it's like was very clear he wasn't going to do like most of the stuff they wanted or really any of it. It's like they'll, and actually even when Stephen Harper was prime minister, it's like the social conservatives, every so often, they would get like thrown a bone, like a symbolic vote on something that they were going to lose, that then like, you know, the cabinet would just abstain on or even vote against it or whatever. So that's kind of how they like they manage their base like pretty effectively, which I guess is the kind of thing that earns them praise from like, or like it would be likely to earn them praise from like, you know, liberal media and stuff. But yeah, that is like the basic dynamic always with the Conservative Party is like social conservatives versus like actually being able to present something to the electorate that is not going to just be completely noxious.
So it seems like what we have here really is a net effect of a more or less a sort of 2.5 party system, say, where or maybe 3 party with NDP as 0.5 as one and Quebec Nationalist Parties as 0.5 on the other, where what you're looking at is two of those parties, the two biggest ones, largely almost working together to maintain a kind of liberal consensus where they each present images to their electorates of we're going to finally fight the culture war on your behalf on the right, and actually we are as left wing as you could possibly be to the liberals. And you know, this was the governing logic of the Democrats and Republicans in the States for, you know, basically since after Reagan. Same thing in the UK. You know, we sort of after Thatcher, we had Major, Blair, Brown, Cameron, like largely switching similar logics off between one another. And and you know, and we see these kinds of coalitions sort of coming, there are these, let's say, informal coalitions coming undone in quite a few major countries, or at least being challenged, right? You know, the when they're challenged, they break right. Because the, you know, whether it's because the liberal parties just have better internal sort of party discipline, because they're less afraid of their base, they don't react to their base as much, or just because that's the way the ideology blows, you know, in all these cases, right? So I, without sort of making any predictions, I mean, is this, we have to ask, is this idea, is this durable, you know, is this durable for Canada, this system that will fight to maintain a status quo as the world changes around it, and fight to do that with ideology?
I mean, I really don't know. I mean, one of the things that makes Canada very difficult to very difficult to understand and very difficult to analogize with other places, like, is the fact that the main axes, or like the dominant axis of like political contestation here, has been about like regional identity for like a very long time, in a way that I don't know if there's another country where you can really say the same. Like the Liberal Party of Canada,
Yugoslavia. pre-death of Tito Yugoslavia.
Well, okay, let's say, like, successfully, you know, like the Liberal Party of Canada represents consensus politics in all the ways that, like, most people would understand, like, consensus between, you know, a sort of illusory consensus between, like, labor and capital, you know, like, you know, et cetera, like, different constituencies. But it also represents, like, I think the real source of its power, like, the reason why it was, like, Canada was, I mean, not a one-party state, but, I mean, between, like, you know, the 20s and like the turn of the, you know, the start of the 21st century, like the Liberal Party was in power for more years than I think any other party in any part of the world where there was like mass suffrage. Like it is a uniquely dominant party. And I really think the source of that was that it was able to broker between like basically between Ontario and Quebec, between English and French Canada. And like the Conservative Party, the modern Conservative Party is in many ways like a response to that. And it's an attempt, you know, Riley mentioned, Wexit, right? And it's like, it's a response to this, it's an attempt to do the same thing on the right, except instead of foregrounding the sort of like Eastern, like Laurentian identity, you foreground like sort of resource extraction and like the, you know, the Western identity.
Yeah, it's a continuation of Elmer Knudsen's Western alienation theory, you know, like to spread the power base away from Toronto and Quebec City and sort of equalize it. But in practice, it just ends up creating chaos and this problem that the federal government needs to constantly contend with.
Well, if we want to sort of take this sort of back up to sort of, you know, 20,000 feet, right? We sort of have these, we have this national story. We have this national story that's useful for sort of not just the politicians who use it to sort of stay in power. We also, it's also very useful for, you know, the largely extractive capital intensive industries that those politicians enable, which is essentially that we are not just a post-historical, but a post-national country. The sort of the problems are basically solved, and they're solved by our innate nature of sort of problem freeness. The solutions and such solutions that need to occur are out there sort of working themselves out. We may have a, you know, troublingly large and growing group of, you know, right-wing recalcitrants gaining ever greater political footholds. You know, no one in Canadian liberal politics really seems to have contended with the fact that, you know, that Doug Ford is Premier of Ontario. But those problems fundamentally are solved or not applicable to us. And exceptions to this, like Doug Ford being the Premier of Ontario, are sort of framed as anomalous, isolated incidents. You know, they are un-Canadian. We're not reckoning with these problems as these are Canadian problems. And so these are external to what is Canada. And the idea of what Canada is becomes this very strange geometric shape that sort of avoids all of these things that we would rather not confront. And in so doing, I think we as a society make ourselves much more vulnerable to them because we cannot confront them because we just push them out of the way. Well, you know, Justin Trudeau inaugurates the BLM pipeline. Effectively,
Canada is out there asking all the big accounts if they like the Heart in the Blender song, and it's fucking cringe.
So I guess if I wanted to sort of, you know, sort of hit on this like extra hard, the myth of Canadian exceptionalism is so pertinent, is so persistent, and so hard to bust because it's incredibly useful to all the people causing all those problems. You know, it's very, very useful to them. The idea that everyone thinks that we are immune to this. And, you know, I think as sort of future episodes will explore in great detail, we most certainly are not. So with our last few minutes, I did pull a little article I would just like to read from by Charles Foran. And this is from a few years ago. I mean, look, we're starting late in the podcasting game. We have to do some catch up. This is from 2017, and it's one that it's about a comment that sparked a real furor, and a comment that, again, I think the furor that it sparked shows that the way it's handled shows that we are not ready to deal with this. So, the Canada experiment Is this truly the world's first post-national country? Quick answers. Are we a post-national country?
I mean, there's no quick answer to that question. I'm not even going to try. where was this published, by the way?
The Guardian.
Okay. All right. All right. Just trying to get a sense of the flavor. I think I'm grounded now. I think I know where this is going.
All right. We have synchronized our ideological watches. And so so basically, I think like the tagline to this would be for me, post-nationalism would be great. I wish we could try it for real. So this starts when Justin Trudeau said there is no core identity, no mainstream in Canada. He was articulating a uniquely Canadian philosophy that some find bewildering or even reckless, but could represent a radical new model of nationhood. As 2017 begins, Canada may be the last immigrant nation left standing. Were we? Are the other ones still standing?
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, that's some good ass writing is what that is. I think what the author is getting at is that the U.S. and U.K. were bad liberals because they got too mean. They were too nationalist. And now their countries have been taken over by the bad people. So they say that Canada, as a country of many immigrants, does not have a nationalism problem because we have so many immigrants.
I mean, saying that we don't have a nationalism problem is like, I mean, that just, again, that's one of those things where like that argument like withers the second you start thinking about it. I don't know. It's like, I mean, I do think people like it's worth celebrating the fact that Canada has kind of successfully created this, like inculcated this idea of like an immigrant nation like that, that probably has helped us avoid some of the politics that you see in like a country like the UK. But this is kind of how you see it deployed over and over again is for these like very fluffy kind of arguments that don't really stand up at all.
Well, it's the self-satisfaction of saying, we've succeeded in doing this. Now let us, like in the Matrix, let us marvel at our own magnificence, having succeeded in doing this. And I think the self-satisfaction of Canada is one that is about passivity, about saying like these achievements, these struggles, they came in the past. Now it is time we enjoy them. So they go. The article goes on. Canada has been overpraised lately for, in effect, going out about our business as usual. In 2016, such luminaries as U.S. President Barack Obama and Bono, no less, declared, quote, "The world needs more Canadas." In October, The Economist blared "Liberty Moves North, Canada's Example to the World" on its cover. And, you know, I mean, to get the coveted Economist endorsement, I mean, who else has gotten that? It's been Macron, Pinochet. It's very hard to get, you know.
Well, I didn't know Bono had said that, so I'm already questioning a few things that I've said on this show.
Infamously, on the night of the U.S. election, Canada's official immigration website crashed due to the volume of traffic. And all those people ended up moving to Canada, of course, we all know. So compared to hard stances of right-wing revanchism, Canada's almost cheerful commitment to inclusion might almost appear naive. There are practical reasons for keeping the doors open. Starting in the 1990s, low fertility and an aging population began slowing Canada's natural growth rate. By 2030, 100% of our population growth is projected to come from immigration. So, you know, the basically, yes, we should be this welcoming. But when I read stuff like this, right, and I've read sort of more updated articles that have been written more recently, what I see is I see the same kinds of defenses of open societies, multiculturalism, small L liberalism or whatever that were mounted in the UK and US in 2016. This is good for the economy. We need people coming in to grow our population. This is who we are, etc., etc. I see it, and it's slight. And again, I'm loath to draw direct straight lines between these countries, but it slightly worries me. It slightly worries me because you know they also say because you know in articles sort of even as recently as 2020 that same speech that post-national no mainstream blah 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 that speech is still being referenced by you know angry conservatives making those same culture war-y points that have sort of gotten, have advanced the sort of cause of reaction so well elsewhere. So in an article from the National Post in 2020, the author writes, Trudeau had clearly stated he wants Canada to be a post-national country. He is perceived as an evangelist for a new type of 21st century socialism, a quiet and bloodless revolution that seeks to control our lives through economic dependency. Under this social revolution, there is no need to confiscate your property. They could, by the way, imagine me holding a flashlight underneath my chin while reading this. They can simply redistribute your wealth through the home equity tax.
This is real now? This is real? Yeah. This was published in the National Post?
Oh, baby, it was. Just a couple of months ago, too.
The voice of a guy in his car in like a fucking parking lot in Peterborough screaming at a dash cam. Like, I want to add, just for context, Charles Warren, who wrote the Guardian article, is also the author of a book called Planet Lolita, which is described as... the disquiet of our digital age through the eyes of a teenage girl, and it's a novel.
What's up?
Just throwing that
in
there.
Excuse
me? Planet Lolita, baby.
Yeah, I basically wrote a novel from the perspective of Lolita. Awesome. It's cool. It's so cool. More and more are saying this is the kind of literature we need.
It's like reading Lolita in Markham.
So the National Post article goes on. I love this. They can redistribute your wealth through the home equity tax. Again, Dan, very specific, very good to point out. This is a YouTube camera guy because it's so specific. Confiscate hunting firearms that were legally purchased, increase a ubiquitous carbon tax, or maybe even confiscate a portion of your retirement savings through a new tax on the private sale of your home. That's just the first thing. They said the same one twice.
Wow, no, he's listed this. I mean, I'm pretty sure this was just like the Bolshevik policy agenda. Like like Lenin was really into the home equity tax in 1919.
That's right. They wanted to levy a tax on the sale of the Winter Palace. Many Canadians rightly fear the repercussions of Trudeau transforming Canada into a cashless society. They have told me they are afraid that the Liberals will impose a social credit score similar to the one that exists in China, where people's behaviors are monitored through 5G cameras.
Well, I mean, the solution is clear. We need to go back to the gold standard. You can't have a cashless society when cash is rooted in bullion, the value of bullion.
Yeah, look, Barrett's Privateers was a very good national constitution. We have to just make that the law.
Are we all not broken men on the Halifax Pier, you know?
God, it's so annoying when I'm brought onto like a can't fail mission to raid American gold from ships, and then I end up as a broken man on a Halifax Pier. Ladies. I hate when the mainmast carries off both me legs. Right, but I think what I'm kind of driving at here, right, is that sort of it is most charitable reading, right? The comfortable sort of self-congratulation about post-nationalism does congratulate us for some, you know, relatively good things. It is unambiguously good, right, that we are a multicultural sort of widely like immigrant society. That's an unambiguous good thing, I think. But the assumption that this does not need to be continually fought for against the forces of reaction that are going increasingly crazy, you know, that comfort, I think, is dangerous. And this cozy consensus is fundamentally not, I worry it might not be equipped for what is coming, and that the thing that people are smug about and are allowing to lull them into a false sense of security, those things are at risk. Quite simply.
Well, yeah, and I mean, there's a U.S. analogy here that's pretty apt. I mean, it's like I think if you're honest about like the scale of the, you know, crisis we're potentially facing, this, you know, all the threats that may emerge in the next like 10 or 15 years, it's like the solution can't just be, give the, like, just let the Liberal Party do its thing. Right. Like, how is the solution business as usual? And it's like, you look at the American situation right now and you have people, and I mean, I see them in my mentions every day, you know, pretty irate because, like I said, a mean thing about Steny Hoyer or whatever, whatever it is. Like, people who, like, think that, like, the anti-fascist move, it's like their position one is, like, barbarians are at the gates. Like we are on the verge of, like, there's, like, a genuine fascist threat. But then position two, like, the corollary is, and that's why it is so important that, like, we pledge our undying fealty to Joe Biden, like a veteran of like 50 years of beltway machine politics, like probably the most definitely the most conservative of any like major candidate in the Democratic field. And it's like, if you're going to take position one, you can't also take position two. And I think the same is very applicable here.
Yeah. I mean, the solution is obvious. Home equity tax on Sussex Drive.
Right. Storm the gates.
So, like, look, this has been the view from 20,000 feet, right? This has been a brief overview history of the history of how we got to where we are in it, of the ideology itself. In future episodes, we are going to dive into sort of some of the individual movements, personalities, some of the financials, which I'm looking forward to, the companies, the monopolies, the brain dead newspaper columnists who are all cousins for some reason.
The entertainment industry, which is virtually the same as the media industry.
Absolutely. We're going to look into all of this stuff. We look forward to, spending many hours, in your ears in the near future. But, I just want to, thank Luke so much for taking the time to hang out with us today on this inaugural episode of The Bottleman.
Yeah, cheers, guys. Yeah.
Yeah, and to thank you for listening. We're going to have a Patreon set up by the time this comes out. And Dan, you want to tell them about what episode's going to be on the Patreon?
Yeah, we have a deep dive into the world of Western alienation and guys who post YouTube videos, dash cam YouTube videos from their cars in parking lots. We're talking about Wexit.
Yeah.
We're talking about Alberta separatism.
And joining us for that, we've got Bertovo, Aaron from Chapo FYM. So that's going to be a lot of fun. In the meantime, I don't want to say a toto-so, but a fucking a toto-so. Later.